For drivers who don't know east from west, the portable GPS navigator is a godsend. Many thieves apparently feel the same way. NPR's Libby Lewis reports on why GPS units are so attractive to thieves and how police are trying to thwart them.
Officer Dana Mathis is settling into her Montgomery County Police patrol cruiser and starting it up. I point to an empty plastic mount on her dashboard. She hesitates, then she produces a Jensen GPS navigator and sets it in the mount.
This is my personal. I just recently got it. So it's been very useful, though, so I can see why it's a hot item.
We're off.
Take next left.
We're on a mission to find the cars of people who've parked and left their GPS systems behind. It doesn't take long. We hit pay dirt at one of the county's municipal garages in Bethesda, just outside D.C. If I were a bad guy, I'd start out with the Mitsubishi, the color of champagne.
What's that?
That's an iPod.
And it's sitting right next to a GPS system. I can't tell the make. Plus a pile of CDs. Nice haul. But we're not bad guys. So Mathis whips out a pen and jots down the license number. She's going to send the Mitsubishi a postcard and let the owner know nicely what she saw in plain sight. If bad guys can see it, the message goes, they'll try to steal it. Some crime experts believe portable GPS systems and iPods are crimogenic. That is, they can actually create crimes. They're portable, easy to steal, and they give more bang for the buck in the pawn shop or on the street than your average car break-in. Add to that the fact that most cities don't have the manpower or money to go after GPS thieves, and the fact that most owners only make the cops' job harder. Bob Mosley is an expert at using technology to catch thieves. He met me at a noisy Starbucks in Alexandria, Virginia.
It's certainly not a crime to pawn a GPS unit. It's not a crime to pawn 100 GPS units. It is a crime to steal them, and that's the link that we have to make.
But most owners don't bother to register their GPS with the manufacturer or even write down the serial number, so no link. In Bethesda, police have poured a lot of time and money into fighting the rash of GPS thefts since last year. They put a plainclothes police team out specifically to target GPS thefts. They started sending out the postcards. They held community meetings and encouraged residents to help watch for thieves. Bethesda's police commander, Russ Hamill, said his officers had broken up a couple of rings of thieves. They were mostly teenagers and young criminals who approached it like a job.
Just about every night they would go out and hit 30 to 50 cars a night. And they were going to places where the cars were being left open. They're almost like water. They're taking the path of least resistance.
The tactics have brought Bethesda's theft numbers way down, for now at least. GPS manufacturers could solve the theft problem easily by installing computer chips to track them. But of course, that would make them cost more. Unless that day comes, your best way to hang on to your Garmin or TomTom is to take it with you. And don't forget your iPod, or your laptop, or your satellite radio, or Libby Lewis, NPR News.
And for tips on how to hang on to your GPS, go to npr.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. When hundreds of thousands of Colombians took to the streets yesterday to demonstrate against a big rebel group there, it wasn't a first. Colombians have protested before, demanding that the rebels release hundreds of hostages. But this time, organizers did do something different. They drummed up support using the social networking site Facebook. NPR's Juan Ferrero reports.
Protesters chanted, "No more FARC, no more FARC," referring to the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, a rebel group that's been kidnapping people for years. Here in the Venezuelan capital, more than 2,000 people, many of them Colombian, hit the streets. Among them was Alirio Serna, a Colombian who's been here since 1957.
We want that all the people in Colombia can live in peace.
Support was generated in recent weeks on Facebook and in the media. By Monday afternoon, police in Colombia said nearly 5 million people were protesting in that country, with many thousands more as far away as Tokyo, Washington, and Paris. The FARC holds 750 hostages, many of them pawns the group uses to win the release of rebels in Colombian jails. Juan Ferrero, NPR News, Caracas, Venezuela.
NPR's business news starts with Yahoo stuck in a corner. $45 billion is a lot of money, but it's not enough to make Yahoo executives excited about selling their company, to Microsoft at least. Yahoo CEO Jerry Yang is looking for alternatives to the Microsoft offer. The problem is there aren't any, at least at the moment. Yesterday, Rupert Murdoch made it clear his company, News Corp, will not make an offer.
Analysts do not see any other logical candidates like AT&T or Comcast stepping up to the plate either. Microsoft is trying to buy Yahoo in order to grab a larger share of the search and advertising business from Google. But there are other reasons Microsoft wants Yahoo, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
It's clear what Google is about just from a visit to its homepage. It's almost blank except for a box for search terms. In contrast, the Yahoo homepage is a smorgasbord of services: personals, games, jobs.
To lots of content areas ranging from technology and cars and finance to food. And then all the entertainment areas like movies and music.
That's Charlene Lee, analyst with Forrester Research. There are also the popular properties that don't have the Yahoo name but which are owned by the company, such as the photo site Flickr and the social bookmarking site Delicious. And both Microsoft and Yahoo have extremely popular email services,
where the two together will represent a vast, vast majority. I think it's like 90 or 95% of those markets would be owned by them.
That's what Google's chief legal officer, David Drummond, was up in arms about in a note on the company's website. He expressed fears that the two companies might find ways to keep users from gaining access to the instant messaging, email, and web-based services of competitors like Google. After all, he says, they've done those anti-competitive things in the past. But Robert Lighton, a former Justice Department antitrust official, says the government won't look at past behavior. They will only look at what a merger would do to market share. Lighton says any decision involving email or IM will depend on whether officials separate them out from other online services.
Once you decide the relevant market or define it, a lot of things fall out from that because you know how concentrated the market is to begin with, and if the merger will make it more concentrated.
Lighton says if Justice Department officials see MySpace, LiveJournal, LinkedIn, or any number of networking sites as part of the market that includes email and IM, then a Microsoft-Yahoo merger wouldn't seem threatening. Yousef Mehdi, who oversees large-scale mergers at Microsoft, thinks the future of these services is in such flux that it would be hard to define it as a closed market at this point.
Across email and instant messaging and social networking, text messaging, voice services, et cetera, there is a broad set of services out there that are going to evolve over time.
Mehdi says Microsoft believes that these services will offer new ways of making money online in the future, especially when their properties are combined with Yahoo's. Analyst Charlene Lee agrees.
If I bought shoes on Zappos.com, I can tell my girlfriends about it on MySpace or Facebook, or put up photos on Flickr or bookmark those things on Delicious. Those are new activities that represent marketing opportunities.
So while Microsoft is still most interested in getting some of that online search advertising revenue away from Google, all the other properties that it would gain from a merger with Yahoo make the potential deal look even sweeter. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Now Microsoft has to find a sweet loan. Seems the company does not have quite enough cash, or rather, Microsoft does not want to use all of its billions and billions of dollars in cash on hand, which is what buying Yahoo would do. So, for the first time in its history, this incredibly rich company says it may borrow money. Most likely it would issue bonds.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. California is the biggest prize on Super Tuesday, but some election officials there say nearly a quarter of tomorrow's vote may not be counted until late Wednesday. Most of California's electronic voting machines have been taken out of service, and that's forcing many of the state's biggest counties to go back to paper ballots. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco has the story.
Riverside County Registrar Barbara Dunmore leads me into a warehouse stacked high with expensive but now defunct machines.
These are our electronic voting units. We own 3,700. Wow. They're just
rows upon rows just sitting there.
It's not that the machines don't work. Dunmore says they've been used successfully in 40 elections. In fact, Riverside was the first county in the nation to go with all electronic voting during the 2000 presidential election.
We were very, 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 very nervous, knowing that no one had done it before. On the other hand, it was very exciting, knowing that we were on the cutting edge of technology, deploying this equipment that we knew we were going to be able to count votes quicker. It was very exciting.
Back then, Riverside's fast new high-tech machines were a sharp contrast to Florida's disastrous Hanging Chad debacle. Florida and other states began moving to more reliable voting systems, and Riverside's electronic model was copied around the country. Dunmore demonstrates the touchscreen machines.
It's letting me review my votes here on the screen. Those look good to me. I'll touch here to print a paper record of my ballot.
But there have always been skeptics concerned that e-voting could be subject to glitches. California Secretary of State Deborah Bowen was so worried she asked experts to conduct a security and reliability study of the touchscreen machines statewide. UC Berkeley computer scientist David Wagner led the effort.
We found the voting systems, all three of them that we looked at, were susceptible to computer viruses. An attacker could craft a specially tailored computer virus that would spread throughout a county, and once it had infected all the voting machines in the county, could miscount or misrecord the votes, could potentially throw a close election.
Wagner says any high-tech attacks would have required sophisticated hackers.
Bottom line is, it was possible, and that was troubling.
As a result, electronic voting machines were decertified across California. That's left more than 20 counties scrambling to prepare for Tuesday's primary. Most are like Riverside County, which is back to having election workers input paper ballots into old-style optical scanners. Paul Shook is one of the election workers at county headquarters who now has to hand-feed stacks of paper ballots. They sometimes have to be double-checked and rewritten if a voter makes a mistake or writes in some unofficial candidate.
Oh yes, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck. A lot of times you get Superman also.
On election night, county workers here will have to wait for truckloads of paper ballots to be delivered from remote desert and mountain areas. Registrar Dunmore says it's going to mean election results won't be tallied for hours and hours, perhaps days.
Electronic voting went a long way to make sure that all the votes are recorded accurately and are counted accurately, and to go back to paper that is so labor intensive. It's going to be a long night for us election day.
Some of Riverside's electronic voting machines will still be available for blind or disabled voters, and Dunmore is hoping that all of the devices will be recertified one day.
Using all of this paper to me is like charging forward into the past.
Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is Day to Day. Google and Microsoft are accusing each other of trying to thwart competition over the internet. Microsoft's chairman, Steve Ballmer, today says his company's proposed $44.6 billion purchase of Yahoo would mean competition for Google. Google is trying to prevent that takeover. Marketplace's Janet Babin is here now. And Janet, why does Google feel so threatened by this Microsoft bid?
Well, Google has good reason, many people say, to be threatened by this bid. It's interesting to note that last spring, Google acquired DoubleClick, the online advertising company, and Microsoft back at that time complained about antitrust issues. So now we have Google doing the same thing back to Microsoft. As you said, they're kind of going back and forth here. But, you know, Madeline, it is more than just a vendetta. I mean, Google is afraid of what this deal could do to its business. I mean, even if your company code of conduct is don't be evil, and that is Google's code of conduct or part of it, you know, the company wants to protect its position here. And some analysts say Google is worried for several reasons. First of all, because while it does lead in online internet ad search, as we talked about, in overall inventory, that is the number of internet pages or visitors to online sites, in that category, Yahoo is ahead. I mean, millions of people read Yahoo websites each day. Information Week editor David Berlin says it's just that Yahoo's had a hard time monetizing or making money out of all those visitors.
The challenge moving forward for Microsoft, should the acquisition go through, will be to monetize all of those visitors and page views that Yahoo is already getting. And that could be long-term a really big business here.
So, Janet, how does Microsoft think it can cash in on all these visitors?
Well, you know, Madeline, Microsoft has a technological bent. It always has. You know, its Windows operating system practically rules the computer world, and it thinks that it has the technology to monetize all of these visitors. But, of course, you can never count Google out, right? I mean, analysts say Google has a way of keeping everybody on their toes, and Google really has been leading the way in innovative ways to monetize these web pages so far. And for the most part, Yahoo and Microsoft have just been reacting.
Well, I imagine this has caught the eye of government regulators. What's the next step there?
Well, the next step as far as government goes, of course, is those antitrust issues we talked about. I mean, the House Judiciary Committee is set to review the proposal at a hearing this Friday. And then, of course, regulators in Europe will weigh in, too. And then the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, they're reporting on the company front that Google is trying to make some sort of partnership or agreement with Yahoo that would stop this deal in its tracks entirely.
Thank you, Janet. That is Janet Babin of Public Radio's Daily Business Show Marketplace.
And speaking of internet search engines, this could be the last month for a browser whose name may still bring back memories. Netscape Navigator revolutionized the internet in the 1990s, but AOL, Netscape's current owner, says it's pulling the plug and ending software support. Fans may be disappointed, but many have already migrated to a Netscape successor. NPR's Elaine Corey reports.
Soon, AOL, which bought Netscape a decade ago, will stop supporting the scrappy browser that introduced web surfing to the masses. Rob Enderle, chief technology analyst with the Enderle Group, is sad to see it go.
Netscape changed the world. Unfortunately, it wasn't able to save itself.
Microsoft's Internet Explorer now rules the browser world with a commanding 76% market share, according to the data firm NetApplications. But Netscape lives on in Firefox, a browser offered free by the nonprofit Mozilla, which was spun off from AOL. Enderle says Firefox is in second place with a nearly 17% market share.
Firefox is the new Netscape, and probably it represents in some way what Netscape should have always been, kind of a community approach to getting on the web.
With its open source code, Enderle says any programmer with good ideas can improve Firefox, and he says that user-friendliness should ensure its hold on consumers who want an alternative to Microsoft. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.